We're looking together at 1 Peter chapter 2. Peter has spent the first part of this letter showing us that true Christians can never really be at home in this world. Real Christians will always be aliens and strangers in the world. In other words, Christians in this world are like visitors living in a place where they don't really belong. If we are Christians this morning, we have been chosen by God out of the world. God has separated us off from other people. Our interests, our desires, our priorities are all completely different from the concerns of the people in the world around us. The people around us live for this world, for this life, for the things that this world can give them. They want pleasure, and they want success, and they want nice possessions, and they want lots of friends, and they want to be admired. These are the things they live for, and they want these things now. But real Christians are completely different. They are looking forward to the world to come, and they're longing for that world, and they're longing for the things that that world will bring. They're looking forward to seeing Jesus Christ when he comes again. As Peter says, they've not seen him yet, but they love him and they long to see him. Real Christians are not interested in this world and the things of this world. Oh, it's nice to have friends and family and good health and success, and if we have them, we're very grateful for them. But those aren't the things we are really interested in. We are more interested in preparing for heaven. We're interested in becoming holy. We want to be holy because God is holy. We're interested in serving God and pleasing God and knowing God. These are the great desires that fill us if we are true Christians. And that is why true Christians will always be strangers, aliens, misfits in this world. The people of this world, the ordinary people around us, they live for themselves. True Christians live for God. The people of this world live self-centered lives. God's people live God-centered lives. I said a fortnight ago, the people of this world will never understand a true Christian. They don't know God. They don't know how glorious God is. They don't see how wonderful God is. They don't see how God is simply everything that matters. So they cannot understand how, why Christians are so obsessed with God himself. That is the great division. The people of this world are chasing after happiness, after health, after success, after nice feelings, after an easy life. True Christians are seeking after God himself. True Christians make it their goal to know God. They adore him, they worship him, they love him, they want to be like him, they obey him, they center their whole life upon him with joy and delight. That is the great divide. And this morning, you must ask yourself the question, which side of the divide are you on? Are you a real Christian? Today, are you loving God? Is he your great desire? Do you long to know him better? To be more like him? Do you long to be holy as God is holy? Are you longing for that day when Jesus Christ returns and you see God face to face? These are the marks of a real Christian. Or are you still one of the people of the world? Ask yourself this morning, what do I want more than anything? And maybe if you're honest, you'll say, well, I want lots of nice friends. That's why I go along to church. Or you'll say, I want to be famous. Or you'll say, I want a happy marriage. Or you'll say, I just want to be healthy. Or you'll say, well, I want to be successful in my job. If that's the way you answer, then you must understand, you are not yet a Christian. You're not yet one of God's people. This thing, whatever it is, that you want so much, that is your God. It's your idol. You're not a lover of God. You still love this world, and you still love the things that this world has to give. You know, so often I ask somebody the question, are you a Christian? And they say, yes. And I say, are you sure? And they say, oh yes, I'm sure. And I ask, well, what makes you so sure? And then they start telling me about their experience of conversion. 30 years ago, or 10 years ago, or last year, whatever it may be. In such and such a meeting, they felt such and such a thing. They understood this truth. They read that. They learned from such and such a verse. They prayed in such and such a way. Tell me about this experience in the past. Listen, the fact that you had some experience in the past, any experience, does not prove that you are a true Christian. It does not prove that you are a real believer. What matters, the only proof, is your experience now. Today, are you hungry for God? Today, are you wanting God more than anything? Today, are you crying to him, clinging to him? Today, are you loving him, choosing him, enjoying him? If today you are not loving God, then it doesn't matter what experience you had back then. You are not a Christian. Where there is real conversion, it is simply the beginning of a life of adoring God and seeking God through Christ. And that is, in the end, the only test of whether you are a true Christian. Not what you felt back then, but whether today you are a lover and a seeker and a worshipper of God. So then, we have this picture. In the first part of our letter, the Christian, the real Christian, is a man who lives for God. But he lives surrounded by a society of people who live for themselves. Peter warns us that the Christian will always be a misfit, always an alien, always out of step with the world around him. That is the message of the first part of the letter. But then, in the second half of the letter, Peter goes on to the practical question of how Christians are to live in this world where we don't fit. How do we handle the fact that we're at odds with the society around us? Peter is going to give us practical advice about our duty in all the different situations in which we have to live here in this world. Our duty to a godless government. Our duty to a godless employer. Our duty to an ungodly husband. He's going to deal with these practical areas. But first, he lays down two general principles to guide us in all these different situations. Now, the first of them we looked at a fortnight ago. You'll find it in verse 11. Dear friends, I urge you as aliens and strangers in the world to abstain from sinful desires which war against your soul. That's the first principle. Peter tells these Christian men and women, you are different from the world, so be different from the world. Don't allow yourselves to be affected by the desires, the ambitions, the priorities that people in the world live by. Guard your souls. That's the first great principle. But then he gives the second great principle in verse 12. Live such good lives among the pagans that though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day he visits us. Here in this verse, Peter warns us that the people of this world will always resent true Christians, and they will always look for faults in Christians, and they will always be ready to accuse us of wrongdoing. Well, says Peter, in that situation, you must live such good lives that even those who want to accuse you are forced to admit that you're different. Peter says, you must live in such a way that through your life, even the hostile people of the world will catch a glimpse of what God is like, and they will glorify God. You see the difference in verses 11 and 12. In verse 11, Peter is warning us that we must guard our own souls. That's the great concern there. But in verse 12, Peter has moved to a higher concern. He's telling us in verse 12 that we must live in such a way as to promote the glory of God. Now, we'll take Peter's argument in verse 12 in two steps. First step is this. The world is always looking for opportunities to accuse Christians of doing wrong. The world is always looking for opportunities to accuse Christians of doing wrong. Peter says you must expect that. Live such good lives among the pagans that though they accuse you of doing wrong, Peter takes it for granted that the world will accuse you of doing wrong. The people of this world are always ready to make accusations against God's people, and they are prepared to invent the most monstrous lies against Christians. The people of this world are prepared to distort and misrepresent and exaggerate anything in order to discredit God's people, and you must be prepared for that. If you read your history books, you'll find that from the very beginning, Christians have been accused of the most horrible crimes. In the early centuries of the church, back in the days of the Roman Empire, the most horrible and lurid stories went round about Christians, and Christian behaviour. You read serious Roman historians, and they'll tell the most obscene stories about Christians. Take this. This is a writer called Minucius Felix. And he says this. He's commenting on the Christian movement. He says, "Already decay of morals spreads from day to day throughout the entire world. And the loathsome shrines of this impious conspiracy multiply." He's talking about Christianity. "This plot must be completely rooted out and execrated. They recognize one another by secret signs and tokens. They love one another almost before they're acquainted. Everywhere a kind of religion of lust is associated with them. They call themselves promiscuously brothers and sisters, so that ordinary fornication becomes incest. And thus their vain and mad superstition gloried in crimes." Do you see? He accuses Christians of being involved in promiscuous orgies. What's it based on? Well, simply the fact that Christians meet for what they called a love feast, the meeting around the Lord's table. That becomes the basis of this wild slander. He accuses Christians of promoting incest. Well, what's that accusation based on? Simply the fact that they call one another brother and sister. Does he have any proof for any of these accusations? Well, he doesn't need it. He simply says, "And for themselves, if there were not a basis of truth, rumour would not tell of gross and unspeakable abominations. These rumours are told, everybody knows these things happen, so it must be true," he says. He doesn't need to prove them. "We all know that Christians live in this disgusting way." He goes on to tell horrible stories of cannibalism among Christians. Christians slaughter babies and devour them. Where does that story begin? Well, Christians talk, don't they, about feeding on the body and blood of Christ? So now that's distorted and Christians become cannibals. This writer, he's a serious writer, a serious historian, but he's prepared to invent, to distort anything if only he can smear and discredit Christians. But why? Why does he hate them so much? He gives us the hint a little bit further on. He says this, "But you Christians, meanwhile, while you carry on with all your crimes, abstain from wholesome pleasures. You don't attend the shows. You take no part in the processions. You fight shy of our public banquets. You abhor the sacred games. You refuse to have anything to do with meats from our sacrifices. You won't have anything to do with the drinks which are poured out on the altars." Do you see? The reason he hates Christians is simply this. Because they're different. Because they refuse to go along to drunken banquets. They refuse to go along to the sick entertainments where men are hacked to death in the arena. They refuse to have anything to do with the vile sacrifices in the pagan temples. They're different. They're separated. They're living as aliens and strangers. And therefore the world hates them. Therefore the world slanders them, because they're different, because they refuse to just live like other people in the world. That's been true in every generation. George Whitefield, that great and godly man, preaching the gospel, caring for orphans, burning himself out in love for God and love for the world. Listen to a godless man, a very cultured man, a very sophisticated man, called Horace Walpole, who's writing about Whitfield. And he says this: the apostle Whitfield has come to shame. He went to Lady Huntingdon lately and asked for £40 for some distinguished saint or other. Well, she said that she had not so much money in the house, but she'd give it to him the first time she had it. He was very pressing, but in vain. At last he said, "There's your watch and trinkets. You don't want such vanities. I'll have that." She would have put him off, but he persisting, she said, "Well, if you must have it, you must." Well, about a fortnight after, she was at his house, and being taken into his wife's chamber, among the paraphernalia of the latter, the Countess found her own possessions. This has made a terrible division. She tells the story herself. Well, Walpole didn't know Lady Huntingdon. He had no contact with her. But he says he knows she tells the story. "I had it not from Saint Francis," which is his sneering name for one of Lady Huntingdon's friends, "but I hope it is true." Doesn't that last sentence tell you everything? The story is pure invention. He admits that he's got no certain knowledge about the whole affair. But he says, "I hope it's true." And that's why he passes it on. He's writing a letter as if this is true. You know, in many of Whitfield's meetings, when he preached, people were so moved that they wept and they cried out. Well, there was a man who wrote a pamphlet attacking Whitfield, or Dr. Squintum, as he called him. Whitfield had a squint. And he says this about Whitfield: "Note well, the hummers, sighers, and weepers," i.e. the people who are being moved in these meetings, "are hireling hypocrites at 2 shillings and 6 pence per week." They've all been paid. The only reason they cry out is because Whitfield paid them in advance half a crown to do it. Well, it's pure invention. It's utter fiction. That doesn't matter. The world is so full of hatred against those who are different from the world. And the world will invent anything to attack God's people. Now, we laugh when we read such things as that. I wonder if Whitfield laughed when he knew that stories like that were circulating about him and that they were being believed. What we're saying is this: that you should never be surprised if you find that you are attacked and slandered by the world. If all sorts of horrible stories are invented about you, maybe some story, some rumour is spread about the place where you work, and finally it comes to you, and you're devastated, and you feel you never want to go into that place again when people are talking like that about you, and you say, "But there's not a scrap of truth in it. How could somebody just have invented a story like that? And why? Why have they done it?" Well, says Peter, it should come as no surprise to you. The more holy, the more clear your witness is, the more anxious worldly people will be to invent or distort things against you, to find anything they can to discredit you. Remember always, you are a follower of Jesus Christ. You are a follower of the man who was accused of being a drunkard and a glutton, a liar and a blasphemer. Remember that he was hung up on a cross in a public place, convicted as a criminal, and the people who walked by believed it. And if you are a follower of Jesus Christ, you must expect to be slandered and accused, and people will believe the accusations. He endured the cross, despising the shame. And so must you. The shame will be there. The ugliness of it will at times make you feel sick to your stomach. How could they invent something so horrible? He despised the shame. But then again, realizing this will surely make you very careful before you believe any story you hear against any other Christian man or woman. You know, when some rumor goes round the neighborhood, or when some story is published in the newspapers about this evangelist or about that Christian leader, you read it. You say to yourself, well, if it weren't true, it wouldn't be in the newspapers, would it? I mean, there must be some truth in it. No smoke without fire. Remember, it may be sheer invention, pure lies. Let's be very, very wary before we believe any story that the world brings against God's people. It is a horrible thing to be accused falsely, to be slandered in the world. But let me add this, that there is one thing that is even more horrible, and that is to be accused truly by the world. It is an awful thing, surely, when the world invents faults among Christians, but it is a more awful thing if the world can point to real faults among Christians. Peter makes that point later on in the letter, in chapter 4 and verse 15, where he says, if you suffer, it should not be as a murderer or thief or any other kind of criminal, or even as a meddler. How awful, he says, it would be if a Christian could truly be accused of being a murderer or a thief or any kind of criminal. How awful it would be if the people you work among could say, oh, he's just lazy. He doesn't pull his weight in this place. Oh, she's so moody. She's always complaining. How awful it would be if the world could say those things truly about you. Remember, the eyes of the world are upon you. And if they can find anything to use to discredit your witness, they will do. Think of a Christian businessman witnessing to his employees, trying to persuade them to come to church, and they know he's fiddling the books. I think of so many churches trying to reach a neighborhood, and the local people know that people in that church are fighting against one another, and that so-and-so won't speak to so-and-so. The world is watching all the time. The world is looking for any opportunity to sneer. And what Peter is saying in chapter 4, verse 15, is that if they can accuse you of being a murderer or a thief, they'll be delighted. It'll be enough for them even if they can only show you're a meddler, a busybody. That's the word he uses there. How often the world has been able to point to Christians and say, well, he's just a meddler. She's just a busybody. Why can't he do his own job properly? Why can't she look after her own home properly? Why can't they look after their own children properly, instead of running round meddling in other people's affairs? Too often, that accusation has been true. And the people of this world are always quick to seize upon it. Christians should be so conscious all the time that the world is watching. It's not enough even for us to be righteous. We must be seen to be righteous. A church must not only be straight in its financial affairs, it must publish its accounts in a clear way so that everybody can see that they're straight in their financial affairs. Christian young people must not only abstain from immorality, They must never put themselves in the situation where worldly people could suspect them of immorality. We must be very careful that the world never has the opportunity to accuse us truly. But now the second step in Peter's argument. It isn't just enough negatively to guard ourselves against accusations, whether they're false or true. The second step in Peter's argument is this, that positively we must live in such a way that the world sees the true character of God through us. Let me repeat that. We must live in such a way that the world sees the true character of God through us. Do you see in verse 12 the word that Peter uses to describe unbelievers, the people of the world? He calls them pagans or heathen. It's the word that Jews used for Gentiles. People who know nothing of the true God. The ordinary people in Peter's day talked about gods, but they knew nothing of the real God. They had no sense of God's majesty, God's purity, God's holiness, God's beauty. The gods they worshipped were pathetic, deceitful, lustful, shoddy things. And that is still true. The people around us talk about God, some of them. They pray to God when they're in trouble. They take their babies along to be christened so that they'll have God's approval. But they have no idea of God as he really is. They've never seen the majesty of God. They've never become aware of the wonder, the glory, the greatness of God. My God, how wonderful thou art. Thy majesty, how bright. How beautiful thy mercy seat. In depths of burning light, how dread are thine eternal years. O everlasting Lord, by prostrate spirits, day and night incessantly adored, O how I fear thee, living God, with deepest, tenderest fears, and worship thee with trembling hope and penitential tears. How wonderful, how beautiful the sight of thee must be. Thine endless wisdom, boundless power, and awful purity. The unbeliever has never felt that way about God. He's never been made to cry out in amazement, overwhelmed by the wonder of what God is like. He's never realized that there is this glorious and majestic being, radiant in power and wisdom and holiness and truth. Doesn't know God. And that's what Peter means when he says that the people of this world are pagans. They may have some idea that God is there, but they don't know what God is like. They have no sense of his greatness and his glory. Well, says Peter, you must live in front of these pagans in such a way that through you, they do glimpse what God is like. So that some of them at least are moved to glorify God. Peter says here, you must live such good lives among the pagans that they finish up glorifying God. Now the word that's translated good lives, and again later in the verse, good works, means beautiful, lovely lives. There should be something about the life of a Christian that is so beautiful, so lovely, so winsome, that it acts as a display of what God himself is really like. What's Peter saying? He's saying this: Christians, your lives should be so lovely that when utter heathens look at you, they say, well, I don't know very much about God, but if God is like that person, if God has made that Christian what he is, then God must be wonderful. A Christian's life should be a display of all the attributes of God. The world should be able to listen to your conversation and to catch an echo of God's truthfulness, of God's straightness, of God's kindness. The world should be able to look into your home and to catch a glimpse of God's orderliness and God's carefulness and God's sense of beauty. The world should see the loveliness of God in your life, the calm strength of God in your conduct, the wisdom of God in your actions. That's what Peter is saying. That they should be moved to worship and glorify God because they have seen God in your life. That is where unbelievers usually catch their first glimpse of what God is like. They see his character shining out of the lives of his people, and they are moved to worship him. Now let's be careful here. Sometimes Christians can live very nice lives. They're friendly to everybody. They're very kind. They're very helpful. And worldly people say, oh, they are lovely. He's such a nice man. She's such a kind lady. And all we've done is to impress other people with how wonderful we are. That's not what Peter's talking about. Peter says that if your life as a Christian is really what it should be, people will not comment on how wonderful you are. People will be moved to see and to declare how wonderful God must be. It's not a question just of persuading people that Christians are nice so that they'd like to join such friendly people. Our lives must display all the character of God. That is what Peter is saying. People must see in us how God hates sin. They must see in us the holiness of God, the God's concern for justice, God's integrity, God's burning goodness must be displayed in us. And they must see in us his love. They must see in us his tenderness, his mercy, his compassion for sinners. There must be something supernatural about our lives, something which cannot be explained by human niceness, something which goes beyond niceness. There must be a glory about Christians. There must be a beauty, the glory of God displayed in them. That's what Peter is saying. Live such beautiful lives that when people see your beautiful deeds, your beautiful works, the pattern of your life, they'll glorify God. They'll say, oh, I never knew it before. But in this person, I've caught a glimpse of a God who is holy and beautiful and wise and great. And I worship him. Now, those of you who are Christians this morning, does that frighten you? Does that intimidate you? The thought that it is through your life that people must learn the character of God? The thought that it's through your life that people must see the attributes of God? You say, well, I'm a million miles from that. Where do I begin? Let me say this in closing. One man has fulfilled this commandment fully. One man did live out perfectly the character of God in his beautiful life. We beheld his glory, the glory of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. Jesus, the dear Son of God, living in a human body, living a human life, he was the one who shone out the whole character of God before the watching world. And if you are a Christian this morning, then you are united with Jesus. The Spirit of Jesus lives in you. Christ in us, the hope of glory. And that is why you need not despair. If I were saying to you, you must make yourself the sort of person who shines with the glory of God, then you would hold up your hands in despair. But we are not saying that. We're saying that you are united with Christ, and that as you feed on Christ, as you walk with Christ, as you meditate on Christ, as you cry to Christ, so the likeness of Christ, the likeness of God, will be created within you. That is your destiny, to be made like Christ. That is the purpose for which God chose you, so that Christ would be the firstborn among many brethren, and so that you would share his likeness. We cannot of ourselves fulfill this command. We cannot become men and women just by trying, who shine with the glory of God. But the Lord Jesus Christ, with whom we are united, as he sends his Spirit into our hearts and into our minds, is able to transform us by his grace. We are living in a very hard and a very hostile society. And yet Peter says that we can win men and women around us, because the Lord Jesus Christ can make us the sort of people who shine forth the glory of God before a watching world. Well, may God apply his word to our hearts for the Saviour's sake. Amen.